This WBEZ podcast is supported by the Crown Family School of Social Work, Policy, and Practice at the University of Chicago, where research meets real-world impact. The master's program in social work, social policy, and social administration blends classroom learning with extensive field education, guided by faculty known for groundbreaking research. Applications are open at crownschool.uchicago.edu/social work. Inspire change. Shape the future. This WBEZ podcast is supported by the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention. Connection is the greatest strength in the fight against suicide. Together, we can encourage those who are struggling to seek help and to know they're not alone. For free resources or to learn how you can get involved in their mission, visit afsp.org.
The new Bears Stadium is down to being built in either Arlington Heights or Hammond.
Mayor Brandon Johnson remains determined to find a way to keep the Chicago Bears from moving.
What terms can we agree upon for our publicly owned stadium that the people of Chicago will benefit from?
This is kind of typical. The mayor has shown up every spring at the end of session.
Hey, Chicago, I'm Sasha Ann Simons, and this is In the Loop. And it's our weekly news recap. In Springfield, the Illinois legislature is finalizing its game plan to keep the Chicago Bears in Illinois. DraftKings closes in-person betting venues at Wrigley Field. Plus, Chicago City Council delays the phase out of the tipped minimum wage, and all charges are dropped against the so-called Broadview 6 defendants.
A stunning mea culpa from the U.S. attorney today.
It's because his prosecutors, for lack of a better phrase, screwed up.
This case should have never been tried in the first place.
Hell yeah, go after the white supremacists. Hell yeah.
This compromise was brought together by the industry as well as advocates. I don't like it.
A tentative agreement tied to the possible sale of the city's parking meters.
This is just a reminder whenever the sale or transfer goes through that this has to be the worst municipal deal in history.
Before we get into the conversation, Sun-Times investigative reporter Bob Hergeth, who's one of our panelists today, joins me now to share a concerning update about something that's seen as a welcome sign of spring in the Midwest. Hey, Bob.
Hello.
I am really curious about this. What's happening to our winged friends, American robins?
Yeah. Robins are those orange-bellied, blue egg-laying songbirds that, we hear probably every time we step outside, at least during certain times of the year. And so I mostly do investigative stuff. But I do have sort of the side interest in wildlife. I like going down this sort of rabbit hole.
Are you a birder?
I'm not really a birder, but I love birds.
Okay. Just curious.
Yeah, I'm just curious of, I always like the natural world and just kind of the trends and whatever. So I started out by doing this just sort of story because I found a broken robin's egg in the street, in my street. And I thought, what do you do how should you handle these or not handle these or whatever? And I started doing some research and finding that there was some recent scholarship on robins. And based on the science that's available or the numbers that are available, the numbers appear to be dropping locally in the Midwest, mm-hmm. in Illinois, in much of the country. Is it at this point catastrophic? No, I don't think so, based on everybody I spoke to.
Kind of sad.
But sad and not good.
Yeah, and research also suggests, migratory patterns are likely changing for these robins.
Yeah, and I mean, I'm going to be honest, this is how little of a birder I am, because I didn't even really figure out or realize that they were migratory, because you just always see them around, right? But they do migrate. And probably because of global warming, that they are staying in some of their colder environments longer and migrating maybe later, mm-hmm. If they migrate at all, including, some numbers and some studies show that probably more of them are staying in colder environs like the Midwest throughout the entire winter and migrating later.
Well, I'm so glad you could stop by and fill us in on this one, but there is so much more news to get to, Bob. So why don't we dive in? Thanks again.
Thank you.
Also at the table to help make sense of the week's news was David Greising, president of the Better Government Association, and Nick Blumberg, WTTW news correspondent and host of Chicago Tonight's Week in Review. Now, one of the most controversial and highly publicized prosecutions from Operation Midway Blitz has come to an end. I'm talking about the four remaining protesters who came to be known as the Broadview Six. Now, all charges were dropped, so David kicked things off with more details.
I've read the transcript. It was a sealed hearing, but it is just an amazing set of circumstances. There was some evident misconduct in the U.S. Attorney's Office. It's very likely that the defendants whose charges now have been dismissed will bring a vindictive prosecution case, among other things, based on testimony. Some of the U.S. attorneys who were seeking indictment against these six people who had protested at Broadview and got indicted. The federal count was that they were conspired to interfere with the ICE agents down
right.
there, basically,
right.
was that they were vouching that it was improper legal conduct, that they were personally vouching for some of the testimony, that they had extra, like, conversations outside the grand jury room, that they were, there were a no vote on the indictment, which, of course, people always say you could indict a ham sandwich. Well, they got at least one no vote that we know about, and that a juror on the second go-around, a juror was essentially dismissed at least, at least one. So,
so are there any consequences for the prosecutors? I mean, can they be sanctioned?
They can be sanctioned, and there are also, if there is this vindictive prosecution case, that's probably the bigger risk because it's unlikely that the U.S. Attorney's Office or the U.S. Attorney Andrew Bustos, who was really on the hot seat here with the judge, it's unlikely he's going to kind of aggressively kind of try to get to the bottom of what happened here. But the plaintiffs,
right.
who will now be likely suing for vindictive prosecution, they're going to get to the bottom of things.
Oh, absolutely. Now, as charges were dropped against these protesters, charges were filed on Monday in Minnesota against an immigration agent. Four counts of assault filed against Officer Christian Castro. Now, Nick, tell me your thoughts on how the courts are dealing with the aggressive immigration raids that we saw in the fall.
Well, it's been pretty interesting seeing, the Hennepin County prosecutor in Minnesota being willing to go after federal immigration agents. Of course, they do have a sort of broad latitude and, often asserted as this, supremacy clause gives them this complete immunity from any local prosecutions, although there have been local prosecutions or at least, charges in the past against, employees of the federal government. But, in this instance, this is a case where a, federal immigration agent, shot a Venezuelan migrant who was here legally. There were all sorts of claims that, that these men were assaulting, federal immigration agents. Federal prosecutors later said that, appeared to be inconsistent and that this, now they're locally charged, that this shooting was not justified. It's very interesting to see. There was also a charge, a county charge filed in Minnesota against an immigration agent for brandishing a weapon at drivers during a very heated traffic incident earlier this year as well. So a real contrast between what we've seen in, Cook County, where the Cook County State's Attorney's Office has been under an enormous amount of pressure to try and, investigate and indict federal immigration agents.
Sure.
Minnesota clearly out sort of, on the forefront of this. And I would imagine, given that we've seen a couple charges filed already, that they may well be investigating additional ones.
Yeah, more to come. Let's turn now to city council while I have you in the hot seat there, Nick, because it's been a busy week.
Sure has.
I want to walk through a couple issues that alders have been grappling with. The planned phase out of that tipped minimum wage, that's being paused. Tell us more.
Yeah, it's a 2-year pause. This is sort of a compromise deal. Back in March, there were 30 members of the city council that voted, to say that, listen, that this phase out of the tip minimum wage is not right. It's going to hurt businesses. This isn't going to have the sort of the economic boon that you think it will be. Obviously, backers say that for a lot of folks, low-income workers, particularly Black and Brown Chicagoans, this is a really crucial measure to try and, lift their wages. Now, when that phase out was stopped back in March, Mayor Johnson vetoed it. They didn't have the votes to override. The issue was dead for the time being, but they did, alders managed to come to a compromise deal. So instead of, stopping the phase out of the tip minimum wage, it'll instead take an additional 2 years for that ramp to start to take effect.
Well, I mean, clearly, this is not what Mayor Johnson wanted. Of course, I had to ask him about it yesterday when he was here for our monthly sit down, Ask the Mayor. Here's a little bit of Johnson.
This compromise, is supported by the industry, the main sponsors,
of the ordinance to abolish the subminimum wage, you know, found common ground here. The ramp for 5 years is one that I thought was reasonable. Now the ramp is a little bit longer. Again, no, I'm not, you know, necessarily satisfied with it. But again, people asked folks to come together and to compromise, and they did.
Is this put to bed finally?
Well, there was one dissenting vote against this measure. So at this point, if the mayor wants to veto it, it would be largely, you know, a symbolic measure. So I think, you know, for now,
I did try to ask him about that, but couldn't quite get the firm yes or no.
There's sort of a sound of resignation in his voice there, wasn't there?
Yeah. Alders also approved Mayor Johnson's choice for Inspector General. So, David, why don't you tell us about David Glockner?
Yeah, David Glockner, very interesting person, new to this office. One good thing that has happened here is that in the last go-around, after Joe Ferguson resigned and before Deborah Witzberg was appointed, it took forever. It took 6 months. The city council passed an ordinance that our BGA policy team has been involved in this. They're independent of our newsroom, but one of our people was on the search committee, and he also had helped push through earlier, one of the reasons they put on the search committee, an ordinance that has tightened the time frame. The mayor has to, like, hurry up and appoint a new thing. So that's a really good thing. And Glockner, he's got a really interesting background, former compliance exec at Exelon, the parent company of Commonwealth Edison. Mm-hmm. Also, what I find interesting, Citadel. He did some work at Citadel, so he will bring, presumably, given the nature of that organization, that big training outfit, is technological expertise, which is, of course, more and more important these days when it comes to things like inspector general work, where you're overseeing government, you're searching for efficiencies, you're looking for corruption, et cetera. And he also ran the criminal division in the U.S. Attorney's Office for about more than a decade. So he seems highly qualified for this job, and it's really great for all of us that an IG is now in. Deborah Witzberg left just a week or two ago.
Right.
She went to work for Chief of Staff for Attorney General
Kwame Raoul. Yeah. Right. Now, the Republican candidate for governor made a surprise appearance in council chambers this week, Bob. What was this about?
Yeah, Darren Bailey. So he's going to be the guy challenging J.B. Pritzker for governor. And the last go around, the last election where he was unsuccessful, he made a, not a very kind remark about the city of Chicago being a hellhole, which sort of mirrored a different kind of hole that President Trump referred to several developing world countries.
We remember.
And
we,
among the kind of ties that, Darren Bailey and to the president. And so he came to the city council and quote unquote apologized.
Yeah. So he called us unfavorable names back in 2022. Let's hear this apology.
Sure.
To this city, I owe you something. I owe you an apology. I said some things about Chicago that were wrong. What I meant was that the political class is failing us, and I should have been more clear, and I wasn't, so I apologize.
Anybody at this table accept that apology?
I think it's at least a bit of an irony that he's talking about the political class being a hellhole in front of 50-odd members of the city's political class.
Yeah, and to have to do it sort of in public comment at city council meeting, that's like... That is also sort of
right.
Like
you couldn't
below.
Find one or two of the conservative alders to invite you up there. Yeah.
Our engineer Ethan says it's giving. I'm sorry if you were offended.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
All right. Back to city council. Another long debated measure was voted on. This one involves police with ties to extremist groups. Nick, where did they come down on this?
That's right. There has been a fight for quite a while to prohibit members of the Chicago Police Department from having ties to groups like the Oath Keepers, all these sort of far right, ultra, right wing, white nationalist, various groups like that. This passed by a 28-21 measure. Now, some of the critics said, listen, we understand what you're trying to get at here. This isn't fair to be targeting the police department. There was some conversation about whether this should apply to all city employees. But there's sort of standing precedent that you can't put those kinds of restrictions in place broadly on municipal employees because of First Amendment concerns. Even if these groups have despicable views, they do have you know, sort of the right of free association with them. Mm-hmm. The argument here is that Chicago police officers, you know, they carry weapons. They have the right to detain people. They have the right to, you know, go after someone if they believe they've committed a crime, so that there should be a higher standard to which they're held. And ultimately, that argument did win the day.
So how will the police department decide which groups should be banned?
Well, there's all sorts of, kind of language in the, the measure about this. There's also going to have to be sort of a policy consideration as well, based on like whose standards for this do you follow? Because obviously, yeah, there's not necessarily a uniform standard out there. You know, the FBI does maintain lists mm-hmm. of hate groups, although certainly some of the policy standards at the federal level around these groups are a bit in flux given the current administration.
Bob, do you think that this will make a significant difference in the ranks of the police department?
I'm not sure. I mean, we did do a story here some time back about hate in the ranks, so to speak. And there is a really interesting question here about the balance of free speech versus, which is obviously a foundational issue in our country, and service in the police department. I mean, but I think what's really come down, because there are other issues in play too. I mean, the police department can put limits on its people. You can have free speech, but then don't be a cop. You know what I mean? Necessarily. Like, you can't say certain things on social media, even whether you're, part of a hate group or not. Mm-hmm. There are restrictions on certain things, including on drinking, for instance. Mm-hmm. I mean, I know that's a side issue, but like, there are other examples here of limits they put on their members. And if you don't like it, then you don't have to belong.
So David, over to you. The city council also approved this near $55 million property tax break. This is for development in and around those parking lots around United Center, the many that exist there. What should we know about this project?
Well, first of all, this project is really important. Some of us are old enough to remember before Oprah's studio went to the West Side, what that area was like. Mm-hmm. Oprah's studio sort of began the revival, and the Democratic Convention of 96 kind of boosted it. This is going to take it to two or three levels higher. It's this monstrous $7 billion plan to just completely transform the area. And this is very important because it is the first commitment of public funds in the sense of this $54 million tax break. But this will help the investors, the Reinsdorf and Wirtz families, to get $500 million in that phase built, in part because they're now going to be able to get private financing that they've been seeking. And this is going to take years to build out, but it's going to bring, that neighborhood over time is just going to be, based on their renderings and their plans, going to be phenomenal.
Right.
And they're doing it, other than tax breaks and some support for the Pink Line station on the eastern end of the property, it's going to be done almost exclusively with private money with the help of tax incentives. There probably be a new TIF district around the Pink Line stop, but this is a neighborhood that can justifiably be the kind that mm-hmm. needs that kind of public investment in order to get things going.
And Nick, Alders approved a bit of a watered-down version of voting rights, a voting rights measure. This one honors the late Reverend Jesse Jackson. What is in this ordinance?
Yeah, that's right. Reverend Jackson, obviously a longtime advocate for voting rights. So there was some conversation, folks might remember, the mayor had floated this idea of these quote-unquote democracy zones
yes.
around polling places. Obviously, there were a lot of concerns that he's raised, that Governor Pritzker's raised about the specter of federal immigration agents, sort of patrolling these sites, potentially to detain folks, perhaps as a voter suppression measure.
Right, and just interfere.
So the watered down element is that part of it is no longer in this ordinance because that is sort of the remit of the Chicago Board of Elections. That's not necessarily something that the mayor and council are weighing in on. But what this does do is, it makes sure that for folks who live in a multi-unit building that they have a safe place to drop their mail-in ballot. It would require that as part of the building owner's responsibility to put that in. There are fines that go into place if they don't do it. It also tries to prevent the doxing of any, election judges, other election officials, mm-hmm. Publicly releasing their information so that folks might harass, or attack them. Obviously, after the 2020 election, we saw a lot of local election officials, face some, in some cases, pretty scary incidents
oh, sure.
of folks going after them. So this is sort of an effort to curb that and make sure that people who are, participating in making sure that the elections run smoothly are going to be able to do their jobs safely and without harassment.
Now, outside of council chambers, Alders have been busy as well. I'm thinking right now of 26th Ward Alderperson Jesse Fuentes, who is suing the federal government. This is over an incident involving two immigration agents. It happened back in the fall. So quickly remind us what happened here, Nick.
Yeah, this was during October, you know, right when the, you know, Midway Blitz was at its, you know, its peak. Alderman Fuentes went to Humboldt Park Hospital. She'd heard, you know, some concerns about agents, you know, at that medical facility, as well as a resident who had been injured reportedly during, you know, altercation with agents. So she was there trying to gather information. She was in, you know, sort of a public area of the hospital asking these agents questions. Mm-hmm. You know, one of them was masked. They, you know, both were, you know, very aggressively, you know, talking to her, telling her she did, you know, had to get out of there, that she needed to, you know, did not have the right to be in that place.
She kept repeating, where's your warrant?
Exactly.
Do you have a warrant?
Do you have a judicial warrant to go after this, you know, this resident of mine? And one of her staffers was filming a large chunk of this incident. And it's, you know, a pretty harrowing video. The agent spins her around very quickly, very roughly, handcuffs her, you know, escorts her out of the hospital, briefly detained her. So she's suing, saying this was, you know, assault. This was false imprisonment, that they didn't have the right to do this to me, and that she has suffered, you know, physical and psychological consequences as mm-hmm. a result of this.
This is in her ward, right? So
That's
she was
correct.
Really there sort of on official business,
yeah,
representing
absolutely.
Her ward.
Yeah,
so she wasn't
after.
Just spectating or making a show. We've seen a lot of politicians make a show of going down
right.
to some of these ICE pro events.
Right.
And she was really doing, I mean,
like
going
you could
above
argue she
beyond.
Had a right to be there.
Right, right. Absolutely.
Yeah. And they also yeah. claimed she was, you know, impeding their work, which nothing on the video indicates that was the case. She was standing, you know, in a hallway very calmly and firmly asking them questions, you know, not trying to block a vehicle or block a gate or chain herself to something.
Well, mm. again and again, like in that Broadview 6 case, when the facts start surfacing, both locally and nationally, what the official line is and what the facts show when we
right.
see these videos are really worlds apart.
Yeah.
And one of the things, going back to that Broadway 6 case, that's one of the things that the judge was indicating is this is part of a national issue that of the way federal law enforcement is behaving.
Mm-hmm.
And one important finding in this case, the Broadview 6, was she said there's what's called the assumption of regularity, that
mm-hmm.
federal judges assume that when a U.S. attorney shows up that they're going to kind of play it by the book. And in this particular instance, that was she threw that out.
Mm.
And that has implications nationally because there are a lot of these cases now. The U.S. The attorneys across the country are starting to lose that assumption of regularity.
Yeah, and it was pretty interesting hearing, you know, the U.S. attorney, you know, say that, you know, we're dropping these charges. We understand that there was, you know, some potential misconduct here, but we still think that, you know, these people, you know, acted, you know, incorrectly, that this, you know, that the charges are good, but the way they were brought was bad. And the judge kind of said, you know, you're really undermining your mea culpa mm. here by coming in and making that kind of an argument.
Sheesh.
Yeah. And I was talking to the lawyer on the Broadview 6 case. He's evidently some of the stuff from yesterday's hearing is going to go up to the Don Lemon case. And so, things are building here with regard to the federal court oversight of what is
going
on.
What an unprecedented time we're living through.
Yeah.
Before we take a pause, I want to touch on that infamous Chicago parking meter deal because it's still making headlines, David. Briefly tell us the latest here.
Well, the latest here is that the investors in Chicago parking meters have made so much money from their $1.2 billion investment in 2008 in purchasing Chicago's parking, the right to run Chicago's parking meters and immediately like tripling rates and taxing the heck out of everybody who needs to park a car in Chicago. They've made so much money that they're going to sell what's left of their 75-year lease to a private investor. One of the things I find most interesting about it happened a few weeks ago
mm-hmm.
when Mayor Johnson announced that he was maybe looking at buying this, and the value in this kind of auction for this lease was set at around $3 billion. And so that just is another indication of how badly the city of Chicago got snookered when we essentially gave away the parking meters. And it is a real moral object lesson in when you run a government, before you do a big thing like that, you got to sort of run the numbers and you got to know what you're doing when you're negotiating about people who really know what they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
And that didn't happen here. And it continues to irritate all of us.
Well, you know, I had to ask Mayor Johnson about this one as well during Ask the Mayor. Here's his response.
I'm hoping that the city council really takes a deeper look at this. This is something, of course, that has dogged the city for a very long time. And it's, you know, unfortunate, but You know, the city council does have the authority to approve or not.
Yeah. So is that right? The city council's authority here. What are our options?
Well, our options are, because the city council can stand in the way, that there is a point of leverage, like to try to get some other concessions, one of which might be the true up payments, where when parking meters are taken offline for like a festival or something like that, mm-hmm. that the city actually has to pay a penalty to the investors who own the lease. Also, there might be like demands to change some of the hours, et cetera. All of them, nice to make progress like that, but it's just really marginal compared to the huge pain that we're all suffering from this horrible lease.
So, Bob, how damaging is this parking meter deal for Mayor Daley's legacy?
Well, you know, mayors since Mayor Daley love to point backward and, you know, blame problems on their predecessors and whatnot. I mean, Brandon Johnson was doing that just recently with Lori Lightfoot. And a lot of people point to Daley. So I'm sort of, you know, there's some of it's just, you know, political expediency. But here it's very legitimate. I mean, this is a huge financial issue that is part of Daley's legacy. Fine, he did the parks. They look nice. The city's great. But like now this is a stone around our neck, as well as other issues like the pensions. And it's on his lap. And if we, and I remind the listeners too, that the company that ended up getting the parking meter deal employed the mayor's nephew, which was not an unusual event back then for the mayor's family to get certain things, for however it came about.
This WBEZ podcast is supported by Wise, the app for international people using money around the globe. With the Wise account, you can send, spend, and receive in up to 40 currencies with only a few simple taps. Download the Wise app today or visit wise.com. Terms and conditions apply. Be smart. Get Wise.
This WBEZ podcast is supported by the Crown Family School of Social Work, Policy, and Practice at the University of Chicago, where research meets real-world impact. The master's program in social work, social policy, and social administration blends classroom learning with extensive field education, guided by faculty known for groundbreaking research. Applications are open at crownschool.uchicago.edu/socialwork. Inspire change. Shape the future.
About a week left in that spring legislative session. I want to take the conversation over to Springfield now. David, tell us where we are with that Bears Stadium saga.
Oh my goodness. where do we start? Well, the Bears likely are going to get a bill that should help them build their stadium, this so-called mega projects bill, where you can get tax breaks from local villages, school boards, et cetera, in order to do an investment of $100 million or more. For us as taxpayers, it's an issue in the sense that these tax breaks that they get for locked in for like 40 years, somebody's got to pay those taxes, and they're going to likely, the cost of those taxes is going to be end up shifted onto other taxpayers in those areas. It's another case where nobody's running the numbers, similar to the parking meter, fiasco. They're supposed to, on bills like this, the legislature is supposed to say, here's the cost or benefit of it. And those numbers have not been run. The legislature so far is more or less ignoring a law in the General Assembly that says they need to do that. But there are so many loopholes in that law, it's just unbelievable. And so, you know, we've seen also the Bears have friends in high places. Roger Goodell, the NFL commissioner, this week kind of said the Bears have two options, Hammond and Arlington Heights, which I'm sure Mayor Brandon Johnson wasn't particularly thrilled to hear because he is at the very last minute trying to revive the effort to get a taxpayer-funded stadium downtown. I don't know where that's coming from. He hasn't really even put a serious plan forward. And Governor Pritzker kind of like held his nose and said, please stop bothering us. And Pritzker's definitely set on Arlington Heights.
So NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell told team owners that Chicago is not one of the options anymore. The Bears issued a similar statement. They said Arlington Heights and Hammond are the only sites under consideration. Clear it up, Bob. Is Chicago definitely out?
Well, I mean, obviously none of us really knows, but I mean, okay, so quick story. My wife is a notorious jinx watching football, baseball games, right? She's known to say at the last minute that the team can't possibly lose, and then they lose. And so, you know, here's the thing. I mean, nothing's done till it's done in Chicago and Illinois, right? And so, no, I don't think Chicago's out. I mean, was this handled brilliantly by Brendan Johnson? No. And also after just kind of dissing on Mayor Daley, I would go back to his regime, and this probably would not be happening this way if he were still in charge. Mm-hmm. So it is a mess. But no, I don't think Chicago's out or doesn't have to be out. I think Hammond is not realistic. I still think that things could come together.
Yeah. And Goodell is definitely putting his finger on the scales for Arlington Heights, because he's gone down to Hammond. He's trying to kind of making the Hammond thing seem more real than it probably really is. Mm-hmm. And he's really doing a solid for the McCaskey family that owns the Bears by kind of that stalking horse is very much alive. And actively trying to push mm-hmm. this far into
that. Well, because you alluded to Pritzker chiming in on this.
Right.
He had harsh words for Mayor Johnson, too. He was talking about Mayor Johnson's efforts to keep the Bears in Chicago.
He wasn't literally holding his nose when he said that.
Let's listen.
We've seen almost nothing out of the mayoral administration here on that subject, or really any other. And so to show up in May and have a bunch of demands seems like late in the game, and it's unfortunate that's happened most years.
Are you surprised to hear him talk about our mayor like that, Nick?
I can't say that I am. The two do not have the warmest, fuzziest relationship over the last several years. Mm-hmm. They are, you know, they're both Democrats. They are two very different Democrats. They have two very different styles as politicians and backgrounds, and they have not historically had seen eye to eye on a lot of things.
Right.
It is interesting, though, you know, there's been some reporting that there's concern among folks in the General Assembly who want to see this mega projects bill that continuing to beat the drum for a Chicago stadium and trying to, you know, kind of make it seem like it's a possibility on the mayor's part is potentially eroding support for this. You know, I think at this point, there's probably still enough to carry it over the finish line. It's interesting, Davey mentioned, you know, property taxes. There are some elements of this bill that are meant for property tax relief for homeowners. But there was an analysis that I think Rich Miller from Capital Facts got that found
the governor's office.
The governor's office numbers. Yeah, that probably isn't going to do a whole heck of a lot for folks.
Yeah.
I want to turn to you, Bob. That Bears stadium funding, believe it or not, it's not the only thing that's being discussed in Springfield. A couple of bills here. One's got to do with capping prescription drug prices. Fill us in.
Yes. So there's legislation. It's still kind of pending, and we'll see where it goes, if it goes. But it's it involves something that's, you know, near and dear to a lot of people, especially lower income and elderly people, which is the cost of prescriptions, and that have become prohibitive for a lot of people that have to choose between, you know, getting their meds or getting food or paying their rent and all that kind of stuff. So this is a measure to essentially, the way I understand it, kind of create a pricing panel that sort of caps certain pricing in Illinois. And so it's, you know, it's controversial in some ways. I mean, mostly because I think Big Pharma makes it so. And also, I should note that Big Pharma is a huge donor to a lot of the legislators that are picking this up. I've done several stories over the past couple of years about the amount of money that is thrown at these people vetting this issue, and including a lot of the pharma companies that were allegedly partly responsible, at least, for the whole opioid crisis, which we continue to deal with as, as a massive, problem.
Yeah, and there's also a bill that would expand access to birth control. This is for minors. What are the details of this one and the status of the legislation, Bob?
Also still pending, last I checked. So we've got a couple of people down in Springfield, wonderful WBZ reporter and Sun-Times reporter, Matt Trunfio. And he briefed me on all this just recently. So as far as I know, it's still kind of pending. But what it does is essentially, if signed and approved and all that, it would give minors pretty much unfettered access through a pharmacy and a doctor, et cetera, to contraceptive services, so birth control and other things. And how that would change is that they would not necessarily, they don't always in this day and age currently need parental approval, but they do need it in some circumstances. Mm-hmm. So I believe that would be kind of stripped away and that minors would be able to then have this. And there was some debate on the floor and some controversy because it's seen by some as sort of an erosion as parental rights, right? I mean, a minor is, you know, somebody's kid. And mm-hmm. some of the talk from what I saw on video from one of the Republican members was just to that point. Like, this is, you know, I'm a parent or we're parents, and who's to tell us, you know, that our kids can do X, Y, and Z. But at the same time, there's, you know, there's obviously a counter argument.
Sure. Nick, let's go back to Broadview from Springfield, shall we? Their ICE detention center, it was all over the news in the fall. We know that people are still being held inside. There was also news this week of religious leaders, faith leaders being granted reentry to the facility. Fill us in.
That's right. This has been a months-long debate. There have
They were shut out, right?
They were shut out for quite some time, and then there was, you know, extremely limited access on sort of an occasional basis. There have been protests. There have been a number of lawsuits on this issue because generally at these sorts of, you know, detention facilities, faith leaders, members of the clergy are, you know, allowed to be, you know, to come in and minister to folks who are held there. So finally, a group of local clergy, they struck an agreement with the federal government. They will be allowed daily access to this facility. Now, you know, an ICE spokesperson said, well, we grant all this access at detention facilities, but we want to stress that Broadview is just a processing center. Now, of course, there has been a lot of reporting over the last several months that this is essentially a processing center in name only, that it has been acting as a de facto detention facility, you know, since Midway Blitz, since all this, you know, really intense enforcement ramped mm-hmm. up. So, you know, there was a lot of, you know, back and forth going on about, like, listen, you have scores of folks who are being held here, and we want to be able to come in and give them the spiritual care that will now be happening.
Yeah. Other news involving the federal government that's impacting us here at home. By now, most of us have heard about the Trump family's tax audit immunity deal. David, a Chicago landmark plays an important role in this story. Put it in context.
Yeah,
first.
Absolutely. Of course, this tax audit immunity deal is the one in which President Trump has set aside $1.776 million in order to help people who think they were wrongly treated by the federal government, wrongly prosecuted, recover
right.
financially from that. But as part of it, Trump has written into this settlement that of a IRS lawsuit, a requirement that IRS never sue the Trump family again, and basically exonerates him of any wrongdoing, financial wrongdoing. It's of local interest because of the Trump Tower, pardon me, where the president is alleged to have twice written off the value of Trump Tower, I think $200 million or so of value that he wrote off once, and then he came back and said, hey, it's still worthless. I'm going to write off even more. And that's been in dispute. And as a result of this settlement, if it holds up, he will would be exonerated of any wrongdoing there. The if it holds up part is that this unprecedented deal, outrageous deal, frankly, is being challenged in Congress. And let's wait and see ultimately how this turns out.
And I'd just like to note the only Chicago landmark I recognize on that side is the old Sun-Times building. So let's get that on the record.
Well, and also, I mean, his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, and that family owned other real estate in Chicago. May still.
Indeed.
While we're doing throwback, I worked with Bob's dad, Bob Hergerth, in that old Sun-Times building.
Oh, did
building.
You?
Yeah. So anyhow.
Yeah. More we
You're
can...
dating yourself.
Yes, I am.
Wow, that's wild. I'm trying to wrap my
you
mind around that.
You can feel the building rock. When the presses started running, it was just unbelievable.
All right. So before the break, Bob, we talked about that Bear Stadium, but there are changes coming to another sports stadium in this city, Wrigley Field. What's going on?
DraftKings announced recently that they're going to be closing their gaming site where you can place in-person bets. They're still going to be online and whatnot. And they cited the high tax structure in Illinois. So I guess it's just not worth their while or so they say. And
so they're closing down in-person betting.
Correct. And I guess the place will stay open as a restaurant bar. But the online betting, it really struck me several ways. I've followed the gaming board on and off 25 years, you know, ever since the whole Rosemont Casino deal, even before, fell apart, was proposed and then collapsed.
Sure.
And it speaks to, just to say, take a step back from this, just how interlinked sports and gambling has become. I mean, I think that, you know, we just assume that the two are linked, but 5, 6, 8 years ago, that was not the case, at least not officially, right? I mean, sure, you wanted to gamble with the mob, you could do it. But like, you know, in terms of legal gambling and that these sports teams are partnering with these groups, that this is normalized, that is advertised everywhere during all games all the time, and that that's exposed to children. So, I mean, it's so yes, it's a business story, and it's a story on taxation that these gaming companies, of course, want as much revenue as they can, and who's going to begrudge them that? But I think it speaks to a larger issue of what's going on in our state when it comes to gambling and how normalized it's become.
I mean, well, is it really a taxation issue, though? I mean, yes, Chicago has very high taxes, gambling taxes, Illinois does, but it's always been that way. And this has just been, 3 years since they opened this. It's, you know, they're shocked that they have to pay high taxes.
Yeah,
I just think it's a little bit more about the business model, that their idea of merging sports attendance with sitting in the DraftKings place betting when you can just be on your phone out in the stadium if you want.
Right. I mean, ESPN has its own sort of built-in betting apparatus. You don't have to think about it anymore. Mm-hmm. And as a result, we've seen this massive explosion in the amount of money that folks are placing in bets.
Well, yeah. And also, you know, the if you read sort of their press release or their comments, it was like, well, the taxes are so high and, well, people may have go to the illegal routes. It's like, you know, what is that?
Nice sports book you've got here. You know, shame if anything happened to it.
It's okay.
Well, Bob, I want to stick with gambling. You recently wrote about potential changes that are actually coming to the state's gaming board. What is the gaming board for folks who we lost 5 seconds ago? And then tell us what's happening.
Yeah, the Illinois Gaming Board is a state agency, so it falls under the auspices of the governor. And it's an appointed board that a staff answers to, and they regulate legal gambling in Illinois, whether that means casinos, sports books, or video poker in bars. And during Governor Pritzker's tenure, Governor Pritzker is somebody not just who's a hotel magnate, you know, drive his money, but also has had investments in casinos over the years. During his tenure, illegal gambling has absolutely exploded, as anybody of a certain age knows. You know, there's certain communities you go and every bar has multiple video poker machines, et cetera, blah, 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 blah. And now there's a casino in Chicago being built and a temporary one and all this kind of stuff. Well, that didn't exist, a few years ago. So we've got this massive expansion of gambling. And so the gaming board's role is all that more important to regulate, because there's more to regulate. And now there's a proposal from the governor's office to eliminate the gaming board in its current function. And I think how that shakes out is yet to be seen, whether that improves what is kind of not great oversight in many ways, provable ways from them over the past few years under this governor, including letting reputed mob associates, into the business, which is what pretty much one of their prime missions is, to keep them out. So not been doing a great job. So if they bring it indoors without a board, which is sort of the proposal, as sort of almost like a state agency, like State Department, less public maybe, you know, is that going to improve things or make things even worse? And the answer is, I don't know.
Mm. Let's turn to public transit and get an update on CTA safety. Nick, what is Cook County State's Attorney Eileen O'Neill Burke doing?
Well, she's already been, her office has had a focus on CTA safety. There was a whole transit task force, a CTA task force that was put into place to ensure that they were, you know, really prosecuting aggressively anyone accused of serious offenses on the CTA. Now that task force is going to expand. So it's going to have folks from, the other current transit agencies, Metra, PACE. They're going to coordinate with folks like the Cook County Sheriffs, coordinate with federal partners, FBI, ATF. So really the idea is, because, you know, they in their eyes, the focus on prosecutions on CTA has had a lot of success. They think it's something that, you know, is worthwhile pursuing, and they want to expand this so that it is a truly regional approach. And of course, this is coming, you know, just ahead of the, you know, overhaul of the Chicago area transit system, replacement of the RTA with the new NEDA board to oversee these three agencies, all sorts of mandates around, you know, increased regional coordination, having one fare system. And a lot of that regional coordination is also going to be focused on safety. You know, eventually there is supposed to be, you know, a dedicated law enforcement agency, you know, a law enforcement task force overseeing this.
Right.
So there's been a lot of, you know, renewed focus on this, you know,
and
after
they put out new crime stats too, right?
That's right. The CTA board this month, Acting President Nora Learson was touting some of the successes they've had. There have been increased patrols by Chicago police, Cook County Sheriff, on the system. They have seen a drop in crime, although the most serious crimes on CTA, you know, your colleague Dave Stewart at the Sun Times did a great analysis that some of the most serious kinds of these crimes are still at, you know, extremely high levels and are, you know, it's pretty stubborn, you know, stubbornly not coming down.
Yeah, and real quick, I want to touch on some work you did, Bob, because you investigated crime on the CTA, particularly people being shoved onto the tracks.
Yep. Kind of everybody's worst fear, standing on the edge of the
new
L platform,
fear unlocked.
And this is going on like insane amounts in New York, and so I just decided to look in the CTA in the Chicago area, and it's going on here. I mean, it's not going on all the time, but about I forget what I came up with. I think once a month at least, and so it's just is it the worst crime going on, the most common? I mean, no. I mean, there are still, you know, robberies and purse snatching and phone snatchings and stuff like that going on that are probably much more common, but it just speaks to the lawlessness that is there and that's been there. And, you know, to Nick's point, you know, oh, we're doing this, we're doing that, and with the sheriffs, it's like everybody knew the problem. Why did it take till now and Donald Trump's threats to get them, you know, to do something? I mean, the crime has been absolutely out of control for years.
And a lot of this was, you know, there was, a big spike in these sorts of violent crimes that we saw around, you know, the COVID pandemic. It was not necessarily unique to just on transit. It wasn't unique to Chicago, but it's an issue that a lot of folks have been raising for a lot of years. And there's also sort of a perception issue. You know, there are all these sorts of incidences. You know, if you're the average rider who's going on, you know, 4 or 5 days a week, the likelihood of it happening to you is still relatively low. But if you don't feel that, you're not going to ride the system.
Correct.
And there have been really high profile cases. Like there was this case where a person was set on fire on the CTA train.
Of course, yeah.
And the videos that, you know, are everywhere now also sort of raise public fear and awareness. And Bob, that was incredible reporting. Thank you very much.
Oh, thanks.
I want to pivot to something that we just found out yesterday. The Chicago Tribune's owner, Alden Capital, has purchased the Suburban Daily Herald, right? So this gives Alden, which is known for its deep cost cutting, its control, it's now got control of two of the three largest newspapers here in our state. I know that you're a former Trib reporter, David, Bob, you're a former Herald reporter.
Yep.
Real quick, your thoughts on what this might mean for both the workers and the public.
Well, the Daily Herald was a great example of a company that competed with a very ambitious suburban expansion by the Chicago Tribune. And the Herald really established itself as the leading news source for people in the suburbs broadly. It started out in Arlington Heights. What's interesting here is that during this sale process, Alden Global Capital, the private equity firm that owns Chicago Tribune, published a full-page ad in the Tribune saying, we're going to pay 30% more than anybody else. Okay, great. So that's written for the purpose of the employee owners of Paddock Publications, which owns the Herald.
Right.
The trouble is for the people who work for the Daily Herald, if Alden buys at 30% more, how are they going to kind of make a return on their investment?
Yeah.
Well, Alden's business model is pay a decent price for an asset and then strip mine all you can out of it and produce that newspaper and the news as cheaply as you possibly can, which means one thing is a lot of job cuts.
Sheesh.
And do it on the cheap as best you can. And unfortunately, that's probably coming. The other thing worth mentioning is that Tribune purchased the printing plant out there. And now, once again, Tribune will own its own printing plant. And it's been a while since they sold Freedom Center.
Real quick, let me get thoughts from you, Bob.
Oh, God bless those employees of the Daily Herald. Because, you know, I mean, like David was saying, I mean, the business model is to just like slash and burn. And, you know, it does speak in one interesting way to, everybody thinks, well, journalism's shriveling and dying, and in some ways it is, but it also speaks to the, you know, the value of that paper, the fact that the Tribune wants to buy it. You know, there is some value there. People do read it, and maybe it can make money. Maybe even still it is making money. I'm not sure. I wish the Sun-Times would have bought it. You know, we're more of a city urban paper, and they had suburban, you know, they are hubbed in the suburbs in the western northwest and some of the northern suburbs, and that would have really expanded our coverage zone. But regardless, I'm not sure it, you know, as a competitor, I'm not sure it's good, and I'm not sure it's good for those workers.
Where does the time go, gentlemen? Time flies when you're having fun. That's it for the weekly news recap. My thanks to WTTW's Nick Blumberg, David Greising of the Better Government Association, and Bob Hergeth of the Sun-Times. Have a great long weekend, gentlemen.
Thanks, Sasha.
You too.
Sasha.
Thanks.
This episode of the In the Loop podcast was produced by me, Andrea Guthman. Sasha Ann Simons is our host. For more in-depth coverage of news and culture in Chicago, be sure to subscribe to this podcast. For a full archive of the show, head over to wbez.org/InTheLoop. Thanks for listening.